I think I came to the meeting, the Tri-Societies meetings in around 2009, 2010, and it was my first time really interacting with this organization, and I'm really happy to look out. I see a lot of familiar faces, and as I walk around now, so I really have found an incredible amount of value in interacting with this organization, and I want to be able to find ways to continue building that relationship between the agency, EPA, that I work with, and all of our partners as well. So I'm here. Everybody's been talking about, you know, some national level assessment, some field level assessment, some watershed scale assessments. This is a really big picture. So take a couple of steps back and think of it in terms of, you know, all the different collaborations, all the different kinds of science is going to go into this as we really work through this issue collaboratively. So some of the data that we know, I have a lot of words on my slides. I hope my slides will be made available. I'm not going to read off of all of them, but I just wanted to make sure that some of these points were out there. The program within EPA that I work with is I'm within the Office of Water, the Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds. And as part of our job is to manage the non-point source program, but also the program that states do all of their water quality monitoring and report on the quality of their waters, as well as watershed planning across the country. And TMDL, Total Maximum Daily Load program is supported out of my office as well. So that's kind of where I sit within EPA. My group does not work specifically on the NPDES program, but we have a very close working relationship with those. I do specifically with those who work on the agriculture and the CAFO program at EPA. And of note, this is just some of the data we know. There are more than 8,000 nutrient TMDLs to date across the country. Those vary for the pollutants that that those cover. But there's an additional, I think, 15,000 nutrient-related impaired waters that do not have a TMDL. So they do not have that kind of official construct with a goal that has been through that assessment process. That's kind of where my program steps in with the watershed planning process, kind of a non-TMDL, and I'm going to get to that. Hypoxic zones across the country. When I spoke with John, the idea of this session was really to talk about the Mississippi River Basin and the Gulf of Mexico hypoxia issue, which I will get to, but I do want to lead off with this note that this is a national problem, and it is an international problem at that as well. So within working in any basin, my title here, nutrient loading in the basin, but you could put any basin on it. You know, addressing nutrient pollution is a very significant priority for EPA. This has been a very significant area that we have put a lot of resources and efforts into over the last 10, 20 years, and have summed up all the information that we have in order to help us on this path of really working with the states. Our goal or our job at EPA is to work with the state water quality agencies as they develop and implement their strategies, their TMDLs, their monitoring programs, their NPDES permits, et cetera. So we see our role, especially from my group, in supporting that with good technical sound information, which is, again, why it's so valuable that I can come to a meeting like this. I do just want to, a lot of this is probably very familiar, but those last couple bullets on there, I just want to call that out. Within the non-point source program, it's really varied. Anything that's not regulated as a point source and specifically called out within the Clean Water Act can fall under my program, the non-point source program, which we have about $158 million annually to go among all the 50 states. So we are a small drop in the bucket. And agriculture is not the only source sector that we work with in that program. So how did we get here? There's a lot of information, a lot of data out there that has brought us to this point of understanding the problem. And a number of you in the audience and certainly at this meeting this week have contributed to this body of work. One area I have a slide on is the NARS program, the National Aquatic Resource Surveys. Those have been in place since the mid-2000s. That's the second section there. And we are learning consistently from that. And what that program really is contributing is to is this idea of big data. And it is something that is available. The information from that is available. And we do encourage folks and researchers to look at that data, ask questions of it, and encourage us to ask questions of it, too. So that is one program that my office is specifically working on out of this list. This is one of the results of the Wadeable Stream Survey from 2006. This was our first kind of results from those National Aquatic Resource Surveys and really gave us a snapshot of where we are going to go with the kind of information we can understand from a statistically valid randomized survey across the waters of the waters within the United States. And what we learned pretty quickly is when you look at total nitrogen in the country, in a randomized survey, you see these highlight areas that I've got circles around. And down in Southern California, that's really an urban and a stormwater issue. You see the Gulf of Mexico highlighted, or the upper Mississippi River Basin as part of the Gulf of Mexico watershed, and you see the Chesapeake Bay watershed highlighted. And there's a lot of work going on in those areas to help us better understand what's going on since this survey came out in 2006. So the variety of sources that we work with across EPA, I just wanted to list this. This is a summary of data and information that we had in a report that came out, I think, in 2010. There is non-point sources within each of these, but for the vast majority of this, we know that atmospheric nitrogen deposition, which there has been a lot of discussion on today and or over the last couple of days here, and I really appreciate that. The ag livestock and ag row crops is really where we see the most significant contribution as a non-point source. This is the type of information we learn from the states at EPA. We have all this information on our website. So the states are required, and they assess their waters. They do it probably around 25% of the waters in any given year. They'll have water quality monitoring out there for. And for rivers and streams, this is what they've reported to us. We know that as a probable source for impairments and a probable source for pollutants in those waters, agriculture has come up as the top 10 for miles threatened or impaired. Now, I look at that next one, and one down a little bit further, third from the bottom, unspecified non-point source. This is an area, the unknowns and the unspecified non-point sources are an area where you as the researchers can work with your states to help tease out what those are so that the states don't report to EPA, it's unknown, we don't know what this is. Because as we go through a watershed planning process, we've really got to be able to identify what those sources are so that we can adequately come up with a strategy and appropriate goals for what those would be. When we go into lakes, reservoirs, and ponds, atmospheric deposition rises to the top, and again, unknown is number two. So it tells us we have a lot of questions out there about what is going on to cause these impairments in our waterways. I can't come and talk anywhere at this point in time from EPA and not talk about harmful algal blooms that are happening across the country. There have been a number of pretty significant events over the last couple of years, and one of the big big things that the agency and my colleagues in our Office of Groundwater and Drinking Water, not under the Clean Water Act, but under the Safe Drinking Water Act, have been working on is coming up with some values that treatment plants can use. Up until, I think, this year, there was one World Health Organization number for cyanotoxins, and it was just a very, very challenging lack of data and information for drinking water facilities to be able to treat and test and know what's happening in these waters that they source drinking water from. So in the last couple of months, since the summer, EPA has had a couple of actions, and I do have the website on here if you're curious about these. I can't speak to all the details of this, but I think there's a series of webinars that have been rolling out over the last couple of weeks on some of this. So this is kind of happening live, and it's not water quality criteria, it's not water quality standards, but these are all numbers that are coming out supported by the states in order to know what some goals and levels are in the waters that are being treated for drinking water. Okay, so backing up a little bit, nutrient framework, if you've followed EPA's work over the last couple of years, you probably heard about the Stoner Memo. That's the nutrient framework guiding principles. And the idea of that is to just reiterate that EPA is, our goal is to work with the states as they develop their strategies. And we recognize the challenges. States have been working, I think, since 1998 to develop numeric nutrient criteria. And so the fundamental goal of this approach is to recognize that states are going to continue working on those numeric nutrient criteria and their numeric water quality, or in their nutrient water quality standards, but give them a reasonable time frame to do that and also ensure that they are making strong progress in the areas where we know what to do. And in agricultural non-point source pollution, in some of the other ag sectors too under the non-point source rubric, we know a little bit about what to do. And so that has really been our role in supporting the states in the recent years. Framework elements, there is an agricultural element there. It's really, really general, but I just want to call attention to it. It's really about partnering and EPA working with the states so that the states can stand up those local and state-level partnerships in order to identify goals, identify the source areas, et cetera. So at the start I mentioned I'm with our 319 non-point source program, and we are a very small funded program in comparison to some of the other ag conservation programs, but the trick of the program is its flexibility and its ability to support a number of different and a variety of different types of work within a watershed. And we have recent guidance that came out about a year and a half ago that has kind of shifted the focus of the 319 program, although over the last 15 or so years, we required, but it was a light requirement, that every 319 project that's implemented have a watershed plan, and this is a 9-element watershed plan. And I don't have all the 9 elements, I think, listed in my slides, but those are on our website, and they're not surprising. But what they are is they show, set a watershed, or identify all your sources, set a reduction goal, identify all the management measures and all the practices and the systems of practices that can be additive among all the source sectors within all of the different sectors that have contribution to the source, and then assess it and look at it. And these are long-term plans. It's typically very small scale. We're talking 12-digit HUC. And it's really focused on identifying those critical areas. But what these plans do is they set up the watershed groups and they set up all the actors within those watersheds to leverage other funds to do the implementation. You know, these 319 watershed plans cannot be implemented without NRCS conservation dollars going onto the landscape. They can't be implemented without the CCAs and the other experts within the watershed working with those farmers to help the farmers understand, you know, what their role is, as well as working within the urban areas in the watershed on some solutions there, too. How did we get here to this watershed planning process? We've had a national non-point source monitoring program for, I think, going up to 25 or so years now. Long-term monitoring going on in a number of watersheds across the country, and I think a few of you, at least in the audience, are familiar with this and contributed to this body of work. So that information, as well as the information we see from the SEEP, the USDA SEEP program projects, have really reiterated to us that planning at the watershed scale and implementing in targeted areas in those critical areas is the way to go. It's hard. It means that some areas need a heavier focus and they might be more challenging to get to, but that is the mechanism that works the best. And so the big long-term monitoring projects have reaffirmed that. Nothing on this slide will be new to you. Obviously, working in the system is really important, but I show the slide when I go out and talk with state water quality agencies and talk with watershed planning groups, and I just wanted to make sure that you all, the scientists, know kind of how simple it looks. This is not simple. This is some of the most challenging work that can be done in this area, and I hear you all in your presentations talk about it. You know, how challenging it is to identify what the right system is on this farm and then 20 miles maybe upriver, a completely different soil type, a completely different system is needed there. It looks like maybe we've simplified it down, but we recognize the challenges, and our training materials on watershed planning and in our partnerships working with across the board, you know, CCAs, NRCS, NIFA, the conservation districts, they really are the heavy lifter for the 319 program, and I think we did an assessment about 2 years ago, and about half the dollars that are going into 319 have some involvement of a conservation district at that local level. So I encourage you to ensure that if your research is coming out and it's telling something about how to manage at the very local level at the farm scale, make sure your conservation districts and those critical areas around your states are aware of that information. And so one thing that we've been really interested in over the last, we've been learning about it over the last couple of years and have had a little bit of resources, is what kind of training can EPA provide through grants to get at some of the gaps in learning? How can we get the really good scientific information that's being generated around nitrogen, around phosphorus over the last 5 years? I mean, I see all the information that's presented in the symposium so far today, and a lot of it around phosphorus over the last couple of days. This is all new information. And how can we summarize it, ensure that, you know, the practitioners, the watershed practitioners, have access to it and can functionally understand it and apply it to setting goals and reduction strategies. And so it's a question, you know, how can EPA provide assistance in that manner? A lot of groups develop training materials. Is there a way that we could, provide assistance or an opportunity to get it out in front of the watershed groups? We are open to that. We are really interested in doing that. I have a slide later on about our Watershed Academy. We do a monthly webinar series, and we get around 700 to 1,000 people participating on those, and they're all, namely, state water quality agency folks, planners, watershed implementers. So we do have an audience that we can make sure we can get your information in front of. So let's move specifically to the Mississippi River Basin. We have two very good models, and I say very good because they are the best we have. They are completely dependent on the data we have, and both USDA and USGS, who are working on supporting these models and running these models at the MARB scale, are continually working to improve those data sets, and they are working together. They have an MOU now where they are sharing information in order to make their data sets more robust. Both of these models, the two models referenced here, are very different types of models, but some of the information, and I think this is in that white paper from last year, the results are pretty similar, which may not be that surprising since the data inputs are pretty similar, but they're two very different types of models, statistical and mechanistic, that are showing us similar information and results. So this is kind of an overarching guiding guide for the groups that I work with within the Mississippi River Basin. And that the main group that I work with is the Mississippi River Gulf of Mexico Watershed Nutrient Task Force. You may or may not be familiar with it, but it is it's been around for quite some time now, since 1997, and was formed to gather the states that are most close to the Mississippi River to better understand the causes and effects of eutrophication in the Gulf of Mexico and to coordinate activities. That's a pretty general statement, but that's why we came to be. In 2001, we had an action plan with a goal that was pretty simply stated as reduce the size of the hypoxic zone to 5,000 square kilometers on a five-year running basis by 2015, which is about to end. and we are not there. I think the five-year running average of the size of the Gulf of Mexico hypoxic zone is around 15,000 square kilometers right now. It goes up and down, and you can guess that it goes up and down most specifically related to weather events. They just tease out really easily to see. In 2007, we had a science advisory board review, which a few people in the audience here were members of, which reiterated to the task force the importance of a dual nutrient strategy. There are times within the Mississippi River Basin where nitrogen is the leading factor, and there are times when phosphorus is the limiting factor. And thus called for a 45% reduction in both nitrogen and phosphorus in order to meet our goal of reducing the size of the zone. And key to the action plan that was revised and based on the outputs of that science advisory board recommendations was to develop and begin implementing nutrient reduction strategies at the statewide scale. And then earlier this year, I think in January or February, the task force, we agreed to amend our goal. We've pushed back that goal to 2035 with a new interim target to reduce nitrogen and phosphorus loads by 20% within 10 years. So that's our new goal. The states are very interested in working hard towards that. The state strategies are in place, and right now we are going through an incredibly challenging process of trying to identify some common measures that all of the states can report on so that by 2025 we have a measurement stick to see where we are in terms of that 20% reduction goal. We have two common measures that the states have agreed to in the point source area. They were pretty straightforward to agree to because within from treatment plants specifically, because we have a national data set of what's in the permits for those facilities, and we can track those at a national level, at a Mississippi River level, and we are now working with the states to ensure that the data that is in that national database, the NPDES database, is reflecting what's going on in the states, and they are working now, the point source group is working now on identifying what some tracking and monitoring load reduction measures might be. On the non-point source side, we're really challenged. Conservation goes on the landscape, you know, by farmers on their own because that's what they do. It goes on through the 319 program. It goes on through the conservation program. States in the basin fund different kinds of conservation throughout the states. How do you aggregate all that conservation that's going in place throughout the basin and try to track that to understand how you can measure and identify where we are in terms of a 20% reduction goal? So if any of you have any ideas, I'm on a work group of about 12 of us, and we would appreciate them. this is certainly something that we're working on. Who is on the task force? It's the 12 states. It's mainly the 10 states along the main stem of the Mississippi River and then two states along the Ohio River. Each state is represented by their ag agency, the environmental agency, or the natural resource agency. I think it's split 4-4-4. Keys to success. I just wanted to put this slide up because this is the watersheds. These are at the 12-digit Huck scale that state agencies and states have identified in their nutrient reduction strategies that they have developed over the last couple of years as their priority watersheds to be working in for the Mississippi River. So if you have actions, you have activities, you have knowledge of data that's in these watersheds in these critical areas, make sure that you're in touch with your state. If you don't know who to get in touch with, let me know. I'm happy to put you in contact with those state agencies. But these are really the key areas states have identified. One thing that we're really, really excited about is a collaboration with land-grant universities. The task force has been trying to find ways to stand up partnerships. We're kind of a funny body because we're not a FACA, a federal advisory committee, but we are a group of government agencies. We need the research and extension expertise of the land-grant universities. And really, this came out of the need for this body across the Mississippi came out of the work that the states were doing with their nutrient reduction strategies because they were relying so heavily on the expertise of land-grant universities. But we do have a shared list of priorities for collaboration that we're really excited about. There's a lot on that list. It is on our website. I thought I put the website on this slide. I'm sorry. It's about a 3-page list. It focuses on strengthening networks and how the states can access the information coming out of extension and better educate those in those critical watershed areas, advancing conservation systems research and outreach around that, and then it has a focus on monitoring, calibration, and validation as we move forward with watershed models and understanding what's going on. I just wanted to mention two challenges that EPA is supporting. This is kind of taking a step back from the Mississippi River. So, John, I just want to do a check. Do we have about 3 minutes left? Is that what you said? Okay. Well, I'm just going to leave this out there. But a new nutrient recycling challenge just was released. If you haven't heard about it, go to our website or ask me, and I'll send you the information. And I just want to encourage you all, if you're not familiar and you are collecting water quality data and information, to know what the Water Quality Exchange is. It's a very large national database on water quality data that's being collected across the country from states, USGS, watershed partners, et cetera. And if you're collecting data, you might want to consider putting your information in there.
Thank you.